Good morning. I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the chance to speak here today, and to begin by acknowledging my collaborators at Los Alamos National Labs and the University of Arizona. Now, we've heard a great deal about progenitors during this conference and during the whole workshop, which is not surprising. And this is a difficult effort because we're dealing with NGRBs, objects at cosmological distances, for which, in the best case, we have light curves and a few painstakingly gathered snapshots of spectra. So it's worth seeing how we can do with something that's closer to home and a bit better studied. And judging by the number of times CASSE has come up in this conference, there's a lot of hope that it can shed some light on the supernova gamma ray burst connection. That makes it even more important to figure out what its progenitor is, because when we talk about supernovae, we're really using a phenomenological definition. You get a supernova whenever you send a shock through something that's shaped like a star. But one that you produce with convectively coupled neutrinos from a neutron star, or acoustic sloshing if you prefer, may be a very different beast from something you get from relativistic jets coming off of black hole accretion. And trying to understand one by examining the other can be misleading unless we're very careful. So CASSE itself, as we've heard a number of times, is young and nearby, so we have a wealth of information on it from the radio to the gamma rays, including well spatially resolved abundances and even secular evolution. With all this information, our estimates for the progenitor range from 16 to 60 solar masses for individual stars, plus various binary scenarios. Now, to be fair, this larger number has come down in the literature, but it's still left a perception in the community that's only peripherally involved with this particular object that CASSE is the remnant of a very massive star. So what we've done is to go back and examine the observational data and say, what independent constraints can we derive for the progenitor, and compare that to progenitor and explosion models and map out our parameter space. What is allowed by each of the constraints, and what is allowed by the constraints taken together as an ensemble? Just to clear up another potential ambiguity, when I'm talking about progenitor mass, I mean the mass of the star at the zero-age main sequence. This is, in general, quite different from the mass at explosion for massive stars. The 16 to 60 that I mentioned earlier refers to this progenitor mass. Estimates of the mass at explosion also vary widely. Willingale et al., in comparing the abundances they observe in the remnant in the X-ray to nucleosynthesis models, find that the best match is from something that was 12 solar masses when it exploded. Doing an inventory of the mass that they see directly from the observations, they get something more like 4 solar masses. I don't want to impugn this group. They were very careful not to make too wildly contradictory claims for the mass, and they point out that this is much more reliable because the nucleosynthesis yields are extremely model-dependent. But the fact that a single group working from a single body of data can derive such different answers just by looking at different pieces of information from that body of data is a warning to the unwary. For our progenitors, we tried to roughly sample the space that's been suggested in the literature. We have a 40 solar mass star, which evolves as a luminous blue variable and then a Wolfri A, and ends up with a carbon-oxygen core of about 8 solar masses. We have a 23 solar mass, which ends up as 14 solar mass red supergiant with a substantial hydrogen envelope, and 2 binary scenarios. And when we say binary here, what we mean is that when the radius of the star starts to expand significantly on the first ascent red giant branch, we strip that envelope and let the star continue to evolve. And we have two cases here, a low and a high mass one, and they produce 5 and 6 solar mass cores, which are dominated by the products of hydrogen burning at their surface. For our explosions, we use a combination of codes. We've exploded the 23 solar mass in 3D and find it takes about 5 months to do the calculation. So what we've done instead for this study is follow the collapse and launch of the explosion in one dimension, then map that into 3D to study the propagation of the shock through the star. And since in 1D, the energy of the explosion is unconstrained, we've looked at a variety of different explosion energies just to see what kind of range you might be able to get. We use an alpha network to keep track of the energy input from nuclear burning and then do post-processing with a larger network to get nucleosynthesis results. And we also look at symmetric and asymmetric explosions when we're mapping into the 3D. More interesting part, of course, is the observational constraints. Probably our best constraint is the presence of nitrogen knots in the ejecta. Now, I should be clear here, there are two populations of nitrogen-rich material in the remnant. There are the quasi-stationary flocculi, which are moving at some hundreds of kilometers a second, and are almost certainly remnants of the pre-supernova wind. What we're interested in here are the fast-moving nitrogen knots, which are indicated by the filled circles in these two figures. These are moving in excess of 8,000 kilometers per second. In fact, with the exception of the material in the jet-like structure, this is the fastest stuff in Cas A. This tells us that when the star exploded, its surface composition had to have been dominated by the products of CNO cycle hydrogen burning. And the typical upper limits for these knots when we put this together was a nitrogen to hydrogen of about 30 times solar. With the lovely new pile of data that Rob Fiesen was showing us earlier this week, maybe that's improved. But even this tells us that more than 90% of the hydrogen in this material has to have been exhausted. Now, what can this tell us about the progenitor? A massive Wolf-Rayet model, like the 40 solar mass that we did, loses so much mass that it gets down to the products of helium burning, which destroys nitrogen very efficiently. So you're going to end up with carbon and oxygen-dominated composition for one of these massive stars. You might imagine a very low-mass Wolf-Rayet star, around 25 solar masses. We don't know if this is possible, but we do have measurements in the ultraviolet of mass loss rates for stars in this mass range, and it's just not very high, or at least not high enough to do this. So if you lost the material, you would have to do it as a red supergiant, at which point the convective envelope is very deep and has mixed up most of the processed material in with hydrogen-rich material in the envelope. At the same time, the CNO layer is being eroded from beneath by the expanding helium-burning core. So you end up with a very thin layer, and it takes a lot of fine-tuning to strip off the hydrogen envelope and not strip all the way down to carbon and oxygen-rich material. Otherwise, low-mass single stars don't lose their hydrogen envelope. So we have two possibilities. A more typical low-mass Wolf-Rayet star, or an even lower mass star, which has had help removing its envelope relatively early in its post-main sequence evolution. Our second constraint is the mass of the star when it exploded. This comes in two parts. First, the ejecta. We can attack this problem in a couple of different ways, through kinematic arguments, which involve the positions of the forward and reverse shocks. These are generally carried out in 1D and require assumptions about the circumstellar medium and the explosion energy. We can also look at the X-ray spectra of the remnant and combine that with emission models to measure the abundances of different elements and try to do a direct inventory of the mass and the remnant. This is also quite model dependent, but both these approaches rely on very different sets of assumptions, and they come up with similar results, about 2 to 4 solar masses of ejecta. Now, assuming that we're not afflicted by coincidence or Schrie's dreaded sociology, then we have a pretty good limit here as well. This is a small ejecta mass, so we either have to have a star that's small when it explodes, or a weak explosion with a lot of fallback. And we should just note that an asymmetric explosion will tend to result in more fallback for a given final kinetic energy. On the other side, there's the compact remnant. We don't see a convincing periodicity in the object, so it's probably not a pulsar. And its emission tends to be inconsistent with accretion scenarios or cooling models. I'm sorry, say again? I believe there's one paper which suggests a very low significance detection, like 1.5 or 2 sigma, and I can't recall the author of that offhand, but in general, there's no good evidence. Okay. So in any case, the remnant seems consistent with an anomalous X-ray pulsar or a soft gamma ray repeater, even though it's a bit subluminous for the class. This is even better in light of the light echoes discovered by Krauss et al. With the Spitzer Space Telescope. So if we accept this, then we have a neutron star. Maximum mass of a neutron star depends on your favorite equation of state, but you really can't push it over about 2.5 solar masses, probably less. This small remnant implies, again, that we had either a small star at explosion, or in this case, a very strong explosion, which didn't allow much fallback onto the remnant. We can also try to estimate the minimum mass of the compact remnant if we assume that Cassay is fairly representative of the objects that contribute to the chemical evolution of the galaxy. In that case, the material that it ejects can't be substantially more neutron-rich than solar. If Cassay is an oddball, of course this goes away, but let's play the game. The electron fraction of material can be reset by neutrinos, but the material has to come very close to the neutron star, and this is the stuff most subject to fallback. So we can at least get a fair estimate by looking at the YE of the progenitor. And if we look at our various progenitors, we get the sort of range that we might expect, about 1.5 to 1.75 solar masses. And these are baryonic masses, not gravitational, so that's about 10% higher than what you would measure in a binary. So we have a small ejecta mass, 2 to 4 solar masses, and a small remnant, which is probably not much more than 2. If we take these together, our star is only 4 to 6 solar masses when it explodes. This means that we can't have a lot of fallback, we can't get rid of a lot of material with a strong explosion, so we're left with basically 2 options: a massive Wolf-Rayet star, which has eroded itself through pre-supernova mass loss down to 4 or 6 solar masses, or a low-mass star, which has lost a lot of material through a binary interaction. The last constraint that we looked at was nucleosynthesis. We have a pretty good estimate of the mass of titanium-44, directly from decay lines of its daughter products, strontium-44 and calcium-44. And we find that we have a pretty high titanium value, which is generally inconsistent with spherical explosions, but doable. Getting a nickel mass is considerably more difficult because you don't get to observe it directly except during the light curve of the original supernova explosion. Lower mass limit, we can see how much iron we find in the remnant in the X-rays and assume to a pretty good approximation that this is all iron 56. That gives us a lower limit of about 0.06 of a solar mass. The upper limit is harder. If John Flamsteed did indeed record this supernova as his new star in Cassiopeia in 1680, he put it down at magnitude of 6. It couldn't have been brighter than third magnitude, or it would have been widely noticed, and probably dimmer than that. So we take this as a base range for the brightness of the supernova, and then take into account extinction. Extinction towards the remnant is patchy, but in general very high. So we try a range of 48 magnitudes of visual extinction, and put together some nickel decay light curves with a good Monte Carlo gamma ray transport scheme, and find that we get a nickel mass of about 0.05 to 0.2 of a solar mass. And the titanium and nickel are plotted in the gray square on this plot. Our models are shown by the dots, and they're scattered semi-randomly around the plot. However, we also discovered that the yields are very uncertain. Multi-D effects in the explosion energy, the initial composition and thermodynamic state of the material, and the hydrodynamic trajectories can all affect the iron peak and alpha-rich freeze-out yields by very large amounts, in some cases a couple of orders of magnitude. So it turns out that our models are sufficiently uncertain that the nucleosynthesis doesn't provide us a good constraint for the progenitor, at least not without a great deal more work. And I don't want you to actually read this table. I just want you to kind of squint and note which areas are red, which is inconsistent with the constraints, and which areas are in white. All of our single stars are up in this region of the table. None of them are able to reproduce the nitrogen constraint, and they also fail pretty badly with the total mass at explosion. Now, you can improve this situation a bit by increasing the mass loss, but that makes the situation even worse for our strongest constraint, particularly for the 40 solar mass. Our binaries all happened to do fine with the nitrogen. They both ended up with a nitrogen-rich helium envelope. And they more or less bracket the values that we want to find for the total mass of explosion. We don't do such a good job with the nucleosynthesis, but we've also discovered that we can get to some level any answer we want. We have a large range, and so the important thing to take from this part of the table is that it is at least possible to produce a reasonable amount of titanium and nickel from one of these models. So, summarize our options. The nitrogen knots rule out massive Wolf-Rayet stars. They have too much mass loss. Low-mass single stars have too little and are left with a hydrogen envelope. Our small ejecta mass rules out strong explosions of a relatively massive core, say a lower mass Wolf-Rayet that only gets down to a WN or WNL. The fact that we have a neutron star remnant rules out a weak explosion of the same kind of massive core, because we can't have too much fallback or we'll end up with a black hole. we take these two together, the total mass at explosion rules out anything but a massive Wolf-Rayet for single stars. Now, if we take all of these constraints at face value, then the only part of our parameter space which is left is a low mass binary with some sort of early envelope ejection. But this, of course, introduces all sorts of new questions. We have limits from HST that place a very stringent constraint on the mass of any companion to the compact object. There's nothing there that's larger than an M dwarf. So if there was a companion, it had to merge, which is actually not all that hard to do for a reasonable range of masses. This upper limit actually goes up some if you change the separation. But what does this do to our primary star? If the primary's helium burning and the secondary is still in hydrogen burning, then it shouldn't have too much effect on the interior. There's enough of an entropy barrier that you just accrete hydrogen-rich material onto the top. So we're probably okay, but this is something that really needs to be simulated more carefully. At the other end of things, we have a binary. We've just ejected a very large amount of mass into the interstellar medium in a very asymmetric way. And we don't see that. We concentrate a lot on the asymmetries in CAS A with the two jet-like structures, but if we go back and think about the distribution of the rest of the ejecta, it's less dense in the north and south, but the velocities are really remarkably circular. We do not see the kind of bipolar asymmetry that you would expect from running into an ejected envelope. There are three possibilities here. One, it's not a binary at all. Two, if CAS A exploded in a windblown bubble from an OB association, the envelope would have traveled far enough that you would not expect the supernova remnant to have caught up with it yet. At the other extreme, CAS A is in a part of the galaxy with a great deal of molecular material. If it exploded in a dense, massive cloud, the envelope would have not had enough inertia to imprint a significant asymmetry on the cloud. Forward shock would have dissipated, and reverse shock from the envelope would have reached the star long before it went supernova, so we may not expect to see it. We just see the windblown bubble from the Wolf-Rayet phase. So, putting this all together, the observations we have give us a set of very good constraints. And if we accept all of these at face value, we get a progenitor that's 15 to 25 solar masses and which experienced a fairly early phase of common envelope evolution, which ejected most of the hydrogen, after which it evolved as a Wolf-Rayet star to explode as CAS A. We also find that nucleosynthesis is too model dependent to be a good constraint as of yet. Probably the most valuable part of this is not the identification of a progenitor, but identification of additional areas of research that we need to concentrate on. On the observational side, I'd like to see refined mass estimates and totally and spatially resolved yields. Ideally, we'd get isotopic yields, and I know how likely that is, but I'm a theorist, so it's not my problem. And we'd like to see evidence either for or against a binary interaction. On the theoretical side, as ever, we need more work on the mechanism and 3D effects of the explosion. We'd also like to do more on binary evolution and its effect both on the progenitor star and the circumstellar medium, and of course more on pre-supernova mass loss. And that should be enough to keep everyone happy for years yet. Thank you.
Okay, any questions or comments? I'd like a little discussion on the that X-ray source in the center of KSA. The idea it's an AXP, it seems a combination of having ruled out other things and then the usual, you know, the latest buzzword is AXP. Can you do a little bit better than that?
If the light echoes are actually the result of a 10 to the 46 ERG eruption sometime since Cassay has exploded, that strengthens the case considerably, but beyond that, I think you're right, it's more a result of ruling other things out.
Okay, then the next question I had is, you said there's no companion. What exactly are these, what's the basis of this statement? Companions.
Companions, there are no stars, doesn't rule out some sort of compact object, but there's no star that is of earlier type than, I think, mid-M, and we get that from HST multiband visual observation saying there's nothing in the vicinity of the compact object or along its presumed point of travel from the center of the expansion that's above a magnitude limit. Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to recall the radius of the observation, which is escaping me now, but it's based upon multiband magnitude limits from HST.
Concerning the point source being like an AXP, it's actually spectrally rather different from other AXPs in that it doesn't have this power law tail in the X-ray spectrum, and also it doesn't have the long periodicities that are seen in other AXPs, so it may really be a different beast altogether. That's right.
I was wondering why you don't make use of the slow-moving knots in your analysis. I thought they would most strongly actually constrain the progenitor evolution because I thought they might be related to a shell which was created before the star exploded, and that would put tight limits on the lifetime of the progenitor in the Wolf-Rayet stage.
Well, the problem there is the supernova remnant hasn't really expanded that far. What we need to do is place a limit on how far out a Wolf-Rayet kind of wind may have gotten. And if it's a long Wolf-Rayet phase, it might be out to 10 parsecs, assuming there's not a big interstellar medium blocking it. And the supernova remnant hasn't got out that far. So basically what the mass law stuff tells us is that we did have a Wolf-Rayet stage which had to have a minimum length and which involved mainly nitrogen-rich helium material. And in the models we've tested, our Wolf-Rayet phase lasts longer than that minimum length. Now, if you go into energetic arguments about the density of the circumstellar medium and what type of circumstellar medium you have around the object when it explodes, or you take seriously the observations of molecular gas in the vicinity, then you can put a tighter limit on the length of the Wolf-Rayet phase.
And I'm talking about the slow-moving knots, which have a velocity, as you said, of a few hundred kilometers per second, which give you a maximum of the duration of the Wolf-Rayet phase. Because, you know, if you have a very long-lasting Wolf-Rayet phase, these knots which might have been a shell before the explosion, would have been pushed to much larger distance.
Depends on whether the knots are part of a slow-moving shell or fast-moving wind that impacted another slow-moving shell.
There must be a shell.
Right. And you can get that either through a spike in the mass loss during the Wolf-Rayet phase or some lower velocity wind phase, like a red supergiant. I've heard numbers of 10,000 years for the Wolf-Rayet phase, which is, in fact, shorter than what we see in these models.
If you allow the ejected nickel mass up to 0.2 solar mass by taking into account extinction, the explosion is very much similar to the supernova 2005BF, which I showed the other day. And but in your models, I noticed the nickel mass is rather too small, but probably it's just your YE distribution causes that one. Is that correct?
It's hard to say. We can change the nickel mass through the explosion energy, the YE, or the asymmetry. And which of those would turn out to be the most important, we haven't done enough work to tell.
And what do you think about the main source of the asphericity in the Cassay explosion?
I don't want to speculate on that now. We're actually doing some simulations now with less parameterized explosions to study that very thing, but they're not done yet.
Rob?
I like the binary progenitor model that you have, but I have a question. Is the envelope that you're talking about that the remnant has not run into yet, would that be asymmetrical? Or would that be just 10 parsecs out and therefore affected more by the interstellar medium interaction?
If it's ejected by a common envelope phase, we're expecting it to have a very much bipolar structure, much denser along the equator than at the poles. Exactly. That's one of the possibilities.
Patrick? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I really like the fact that you took all these constraints into account. I was wondering, I think 2 or 3 years ago, there was a couple of papers, one by Chevalier and Oishi, one by Martin, Laming, and Una, and they both sort of concluded that, I thought they looked at most of the same similar constraints, and they concluded there was a red supergiant wind, and I think these guys also had, a Wolf-Rayet wind in the picture. So how does, I don't remember the details, but how does your analysis differ from them in the sense that why do you come to such a different conclusion? Is this any more constraints, or is it just that you're looking at them differently? Or
it's more a matter of looking at it a little bit differently. We don't try to do any serious kinematic analysis on the circumstellar medium aside from the abundances. We take that from the literature. And if you agree that there's evidence of a red supergiant wind in the circumstellar medium, then the Wolf-Rayet phase must have been very short, and you're left with a puzzle of how to do that with the stellar models that we have. That's one of the more model-dependent constraints, so we decided to just sweep that under the rug, more or less. I don't know. I think I would have to do a lot of simulation of the interaction with the circumstellar medium before I was competent to say one way or the other.
In our paper, I think we just used the spectroscopy and the kinematics to place limits on ejected mass, circumstellar density, and things like that, without really trying to think too hard about what the precise progenitor would have been to produce those things.
Yeah.
just to add to that, I think the evidence is that the density of the circumstellar wind is much denser than you'd expect for any Wolfram A star, and is consistent with a red supergiant wind. So you know, just the densities that you got, and we estimated also.
Density, I think, is one of the more robust.
Yeah.
Well, you have some nucleosynthesis constraints, but I think one of the key constraints is also that the oxygen seems to be something like 1 to 2 solar masses. So for a very high mass Wolfram A star, you expect much more oxygen. So I think that's, and that's made clear because it doesn't depend so much on the explosion properties.
Yeah, that's a good point. It depends on how hard you hit it, of course, and we have considerable freedom. Roger, I believe, suggested a 4FO explosion for a low mass progenitor. Yeah, so we can do pretty much whatever we want to there, but yeah, that's a good point.
Okay, if there are no further questions, we'll break for coffee, reconvene at 10:50.